Welcome to Conversations on a Tightrope. This is Atrevida, and this is the fourth show on atheism. We will be sharing a 2004 interview with Steven Weinberg, recorded by Jonathan Miller of the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. Steven Weinberg is an American Nobel Prize-winning physicist. But before I tell you more about him and play the interview, I would like to share a brief audio of Tim Minchin, who is an Australian musician, comedian, and atheist, and also pro-science. I will also follow this with a short CNN interview with comedian Ricky Gervais, who also has a love of science. Tim Minchin wrote and produced this acclaimed 9-minute beat poem, Storm, which is a discussion with a female called Storm, to whom he rants on about her spiritual, mystical beliefs. I have edited it due to time constraints, but you can see the entire YouTube video by searching for Tim Minchin, Storm.
It's not long before Storm gets started, she opines.
You can't know anything. Knowledge is merely opinion. There are more things in heaven and earth than exist in your philosophy. Science is just how we're trained to look at reality. It doesn't explain love or spirituality. How does science explain psychics, auras, the afterlife?
Look, Storm, sorry, I don't mean to bore you, but there's no such thing as an aura. Reading auras is like reading minds, or tea leaves, or star signs, or meridian lines. These people aren't plying a skill. They're either lying or mentally ill. Same goes for people who claim they can hear God's demands, or spiritual healers who think they've got magic hands. Storm, to her credit, despite my derision, keeps firing off cliches with startling precision. You're so sure of your position, but you're just closed-minded. I think you'll find that your faith in science and tests is just as blind as the faith of any fundamentalist. Wow, that's a good point. Let me think for a bit. Oh, wait, my mistake. That's absolute bull. Science adjusts its views based on what's observed. Faith is the denial of observations so that belief can be preserved. Life is full of mysteries, yeah, but there are answers out there and they won't be found by people sitting around looking serious and saying, isn't life mysterious? Let's sit here and hope. Let's call up the Pope. Let's go watch Oprah interview Deepak Chopra. Throughout history, every mystery ever solved has turned out to be not magic. Does the idea that there might be knowledge frighten you? Does the idea that one afternoon on Wikipedia might enlighten you frighten you? Does the notion that there might not be a supernatural so blow your hippie noodle that you'd rather just stand in the fog of your inability to Google? Isn't this enough? Just this world? Just this beautiful, complex, wonderfully unfathomable natural world? How does it so fail to hold our attention that we have to diminish it with the invention of cheap, man-made myths and monsters? I am a tiny, insignificant, ignorant bit of carbon. I have one life, and it is short and unimportant. But thanks to recent scientific advances, I get to live twice as long as my great-great-great-great uncles and aunts. Twice as long to live this life of mine. Twice as long to love this wife of mine. Twice as many years of friends and wine, of sharing curries. And if, perchance, I have offended, think but this, and all is mended. We'd as well be 10 minutes back in time for all the chance you'll change your mind.
This religious friend of mine, arguments often end with him telling me that I'm not very open-minded. And because he's my friend and I respect him, I've written him a song. It's called, If You Open Your Mind Too Much, Your Brain Will Fall Out. Which I think is brilliant. So clever. Unfortunately, I didn't come up with it myself. I read that in a book. So to avoid copyright issues, I've given it a subtitle, which is, Take My Wife! If anyone can show me one example in the history of the world of a single psychic who's been able to prove under reasonable experimental conditions that they are able to read minds. And if anyone can show me one example in the history of the world of a single astrologer who's been able to prove under reasonable experimental conditions that they can predict future human events by interpreting celestial signs. And if anyone can show me one example in the history of the world of a single spiritual person who's been able to show either empirically or logically the existence of a higher power with any consciousness or interest in the human race, or ability to punish or reward humans for their moral choices, or that there is any reason other than fear to believe in any version of an afterlife, I will give you my piano, one of my legs, and my wife.
Now let's listen to the usually very funny Ricky Gervais, who explains to CNN's Piers Morgan in a serious fashion his position on his non-theist beliefs and why he should have the right to express them. You can also find this YouTube video by searching CNN Piers Morgan interview with Ricky Gervais.
If you're a believer in God, if you're a Christian, as many tens of millions in America are, you could see you as poking fun at their religion.
Not at all. When someone thanks God, I don't get offended. How many people thank God every time they say thank God? I don't get offended. Do I?
But you must be aware that a lot of people in America would potentially find that offensive.
What, because I'm saying I don't believe in God?
Yeah, because you're kind of mocking them, you know.
No, I'm not. I'm not mocking them. People's beliefs aren't my concern at all. I certainly don't differentiate between religions either. I look at all religions the same. Unlike religious people, I look at all religions equally.
You were religious till you were about 8 years old, is that right?
Yeah, I was brought up a Christian, yeah.
And what happened to change your mind then?
I used to go to Sunday school all the time. I believed in... We got to realise that when you're a working class kid, I came from a very poor working class background. My dad was a labourer, my mum was a housewife. I lived in a poor estate, over here, like the projects. Right? And to a working class mum, her hope isn't that you become a doctor or a lawyer or an international comedian, it's that you don't die in a barroom fight. Mm. And they think the best way to do that is to take on Christian values, which preach immorality. But they haven't got the monopoly on good. This is my point. I'm not a Christian, but I live my life in a good way. And some people say, well, who says what's good is? Well, do you know what? I do. I'm good to people because it's the way I want to be treated. And I don't believe I'll be rewarded in heaven, but I do believe...
What do you think will happen to you?
I'll be rewarded now.
But when you die, what do you think happens?
People who liked me or remember me.
But what happens to you? Anything?
What, my physical body?
Yeah, yeah.
It breaks down or
your
gets
spirit,
burnt.
Anything happen to that?
I don't believe there is a spirit. I think the spirit is an upshot of all your inputs, your beliefs. Some people think you can't believe in love if you're an atheist. Of course I believe in love. Of course I believe in the beauty of nature. I just believe that the Earth was made over 4.5 billion years and not by design in 6 days. And, you know, I wasn't being disrespectful, but I think I have the right to say I'm not a believer in God, just like everyone has the right to believe in God. And spirituality is very different to religion, let's not forget that.
Are you a spiritual person, do you think?
Well, not in that sense. But I get a funny feeling when I see a friend or a mountain or an animal. It fills me with joy. My first love is science and nature.
Before I play the interview, I would like to read parts of an essay by Douglas O. Linder in 2005 on Steven Weinberg. Teachers at the Bronx High School in New York encouraged young Steven Weinberg's interest in science, and by 1949, the 16-year-old decided he would like to make a career out of theoretical physics. Weinberg would eventually win the Nobel Prize in Physics for developing a theory that unified electromagnetic force and the so-called weak interaction, two of the four fundamental forces. He is celebrated as the world's most authoritative proponent of the idea that physics is hurtling towards a final theory, a complete explanation of nature's particles and forces that will endure as the bedrock of all science forevermore. Among scientists, if not the general public, Weinberg ranks as an intellectual icon even above British physicist Stephen Hawking. In his The First 3 Minutes, Weinberg's attempt to describe the first 3 minutes of our universe's existence, he argues that the search for scientific truth can give meaning to life. The effort to understand the universe is one of the very few things that lifts human life a little above the level of farce and gives it some of the grace of tragedy. According to Weinberg, the better we understand nature, the more the scientist's sense of wonder has expanded as he or she grapples with the remaining mysteries. Ever the secular rationalist, Weinberg is known among scientists for his outspoken opinions on the subject of religion. Weinberg told a New York Times interviewer in 1999, "With or without religion, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion." His hostility to religion seems to have grown. As time has passed, he observed, "My feelings have gotten stronger and stronger. I really dislike religion intensely." On one major question, however, Steven Weinberg is in complete agreement with many fundamentalists. Weinberg believes that evolution, if taught properly, will reduce a student's sense of his or her own special importance, because it means science can help each of us grow up as an individual. Weinberg is scornful of those who describe science as just one way among many of finding truth. Science is the path to truth, Weinberg thinks, and he is not shy about showing his irritation with philosophers who disagree. Some people wonder why Weinberg seems so determined to refute claims that the world is the work of a benevolent designer. The answer he gives is that, on balance, the moral influence of religion has been awful. Weighing the jihads and crusades against evangelical campaigns to end slavery, Weinberg concludes religion has done humanity more harm than good. He has no interest in maintaining a constructive dialogue between science and religion. He looks forward to the day when people comprehend that nature is governed by impersonal laws, laws that do not give any special status to life, and yet laws that humans are able to discover and understand. Let me give you a brief synopsis of Part 1. In Part 1, Weinberg and Miller talk about Galileo, Newton, St. Augustine, who were all very religious and scientific in the pursuit of the universe and how it works. Then he mentions Darwin and Wallace and reflects on Darwin losing his religious faith because of his discovery of evolution and natural selection. May I suggest to those of you who are not familiar with these scientists or theologians to Google them, and you will be amazed at the information presented briefly or in depth. Jonathan Miller asks what Weinberg thinks about physicists who say the regularity of nature points to a designer, and Weinberg explains why he disagrees. He answers that there will always be a mystery, even after science solves each mystery. A designer doesn't solve any mysteries. Where did the designer come from? We will not ever be able to solve all mysteries, and we have to live with that. He also says that what people really care about is basically their own lives, the here and now, and not the complex explanations of science. He believes that people are religious because they know they will die and all things will end, and that is the driving force for religion. Now let's listen.
Now, the Nobel Prize-winning American physicist Steven Weinberg has often addressed himself to what he sees as the pernicious effects of religion. And when I met him in Texas, I started by asking him how he reacted to the fact that the physicists who were his own intellectual predecessors had seen the physical regularity of the universe and the beauty of the earth to be incontrovertible evidence of divine design.
Looking at nature in the past, the impression of design must have been overwhelming.
It's such a comfortable, pleasant earth, and things work out so well. Well, as we learn more and more about the universe, it seems not such a friendly place, and we appear just to have been winners in a cosmic lottery.
And yet there might be those believers who might say, yes, admittedly, there are other celestial bodies which are not good stage sets for life, let alone for the human drama, but here we are on Earth, which is, as they would say, convivially arranged to accommodate
life. Well, what would you expect? I mean, with all these billions and billions of planets, some of them are going to be comfortable, and it's only on those that life can arise.
But people like Newton, for example, and Samuel Clarke, who wrote, as it were, on his behalf later on at Trinity when he did the Boyle lectures, was not invoking the comfort and conviviality of the Earth. Newton was impressed by the regularity of nature. Whether or not it was a suitable setting for the human drama, he thought that the laws of motion and the arrangement of the celestial system expressed design regardless of its suitability for human existence.
Yes, and he was religious. He saw the universe as a great puzzle, just as he saw the Book of Daniel as a great puzzle. And it was God leaving messages for human beings to puzzle out. And he puzzled out the way the solar system worked, and he tried to puzzle out the chronology of the Bible. Well, we don't do that anymore.
But might there be any reason, and in fact you still find people, and indeed some of your own colleagues, who feel that nevertheless the regularity, by definition, involves and invokes a regulator?
Well, it doesn't. There is a mystery, I have to admit. We try to understand nature, and we ask questions, and we get answers, and then we ask more follow-up questions. Well, why is that true? And we hope to come to some set of elegant physical principles that describe everything. And when we have it, the mystery will still be there, because we'll always have to ask, why is it that theory and not some other theory? And one answer is, well, that is the regularity imposed on it by a spirit, a designer. But that doesn't answer anything. I mean, then you have to say, well, why is the designer like that? You know, either by a designer you have something in particular in mind, a god who is benevolent or jealous or humorous, whatever, or you have nothing in mind. If you have nothing in mind, let's not talk about it. And if you have something in mind, then the question arises, well, why is that true? So I don't see that having a designer puts us at rest. I think we're permanently in the tragic position of not being able to understand at the deepest possible level why things are the way they are. And we'll just have to live with that. But saying, well, it's a designer, doesn't settle it, doesn't help.
But let's say, and I'm being, as it were, the deist's advocate here, instead of the devil's advocate, let's say that it doesn't exhibit doesn't answer the question of design, but if there is this insuperable mystery, might one understand how it is that people feel that in the presence of such a mystery, that they, as it were, it's the thin end of some sort of theological wedge into which spirituality or an originator can be inserted?
Oh,
I mean, I don't feel that.
I don't feel that way either. I suppose many do. I think much more likely is that people are religious because they know they're going to die, and they know their loved ones are going to die, and that's the tragedy. It's not that that bothers them. It's not the tragedy of not being able to come to the final cause. It's the tragedy of knowing that your life and all the wonderful things that you can do and living and the people you love, that that's all going to end. It seems to me that provides the driving force for religion much more than these philosophical wonderings about first cause. These issues of the beginning of time were discussed very intelligently long ago by Augustine, and who grappled with the question of what there was before time began, and he said God created the world with time, that time was created, there was no before, that that's part of the creation. That's as good an answer as any, I guess.
But it is interesting that someone like Augustine, without the benefits of quantum physics, without the benefits of Einstein, without the benefits of any of your sort of work, was able to invoke ideas such as time itself having a beginning.
Well, Augustine was a very clever man, and it's wonderful, looking back over all the thousands of years of speculation about these things, that time, I think first with Galileo, became part of the ordinary ambit of science. I mean, Galileo was the first person who tried to measure time during a physical process, measured the time it took for various balls to roll down an inclined plane, and he got the rule that the distance traveled is proportional to the square of the time. Nobody before had ever tried to bring time into the laws of nature quantitatively.
But for Galileo, observing these regularities and observing the relationship between these balls rolling down slopes, the time it took, and giving a mathematical expression for that, for him, as an unquestioningly religious man, they were, in fact, demonstrations of God's mind.
Well, I don't think Galileo came to that conclusion. If he did, I'm not aware of it. But if what you're suggesting is that there is no necessary conflict between being a scientist and being religious, I suppose I have to agree. There, even now, there are very fine scientists who are deeply religious. I know a few. But I think what happened, and it only began to happen with Galileo and Newton, so it took a long time to mature. What happened was that much of the early basis for religious belief was dissolved by science. It wasn't that scientific discoveries made religion impossible. It's that they made irreligion possible. It became possible to understand how things worked without the religious explanation. And particularly, I think more important than anything any physicist did was what Darwin did, Darwin and Wallace.
Yes, well, this is the argument which we've had, I think from Dennett, from Daniel Dennett. He feels that perhaps the most wounding influence upon religion really came with Darwin rather than with Galileo.
Oh, I agree, I agree. Even though it hurts my pride as a physicist to say so, because people don't really care that much about the way the planets go around the sun, or the way certainly they don't care about the balls rolling down the inclined plane. What they care about is life, and particularly their own life, and their relationship to the causes for them being the way they are. They care about that. And Darwin's revision of the understanding of why living things are the way they are, in particular why people are the way they are, was overwhelming, and Darwin himself lost his faith.
While digesting what Steven Weinberg has just said, let's listen to Darwin's Revolution Evolution song that I found on YouTube, written and performed by a handler with the name U2B Monkey.
Cell by cell, multiplicating, copying DNA through our generations, but sometimes it's not copied right. Now this causes changing if it's beneficial, species breeds and passes on its genes, and so it goes in evolution. Yeah, it's evolution, it's Darwin's revolution, and it teaches us the history of life, yeah, of life, it's evolution. Some say Darwin was an evil man, set out to destroy religion, but that's not true. He was looking to find the mechanism of variation we see in life. Yeah, we see in life, which is evolution. Yeah, it's evolution. Yeah, it's Darwin's revolution. And it teaches us the history of life. Yeah, of life, it's evolution. Natural selection and mutation, genetic drift and gene flow. If you'll learn these four principles, then you will know what Darwin told. Yeah, what Darwin told of evolution. Yeah, it's evolution, yeah, it's Darwin's revolution, and it teaches us the history of life, yeah, of life, it's evolution. It's evolution. Evolution.
Now, in part two, Weinberg also reflects on Cardinal Manning, whom he says had read Paley's Natural Theology and became convinced that there was a creator. And then Darwin comes into the picture suddenly, saying there was no creator and unsettles religious belief. To Weinberg, Darwin made the most significant contribution to science. He compares Hinduism, Judaism, Vishnu, etc., to more fundamentalist religions like Christianity, Buddhist. Ironically, he is attracted to the fundamentalist beliefs because he feels they at least believe in something. They have a theory, and as a scientist, he searches for truth. He does emphasize that he's attracted to the fundamentalists, although he disagrees with their theory. And then he explains his feeling that real harm is done by religion, not in the name of, but actually by religion. So let's continue.
You know, I was recently rereading Lytton Strachey's wonderful little biography of Cardinal Manning in Eminent Victorians, and Manning said that he became convinced, a convinced Christian, because of reading Paley's
Natural Theology. Yeah.
Yes, and the wonderful adaptation of living things convinced him that there had to be a creator, a personality that created all this. And suddenly that was gone. there wasn't a discovery that there wasn't a creator, but the argument was removed. And I don't think anything in that science has done for general culture has ever been as important as that.
Yes, it is interesting to find that, on the whole, the percentage of biological disbelievers in the scientific community is higher than the percentage of disbelievers amongst your colleagues in physics and chemistry.
Is that true? I didn't know that. Actually, I've occasionally, not too often, gotten into conversations with my physicist colleagues about religion. I find an overwhelming lack of interest in it. I once said that they don't care enough about it to qualify as practicing atheists. They just regard it as a sort of question that it's silly to raise. And I, for some obscure reason, I tend to care about it, and I'm interested in religion, but most of my physicist friends are not. But you find such a variety of beliefs. I have one friend, a very distinguished astrophysicist, who told me that he's an Orthodox observant Jew, which is a lot of trouble, you know, that's not easy, and doesn't believe in God. Because for him, the religion is a framework for life that he inherited from his parents. He grew up with it. He wants to stay in it. But he doesn't think there's anything behind it. I think probably a fair number of people in the Church of England feel that way.
I think for a number of people, the retreat into religion is, as you say, not a retreat into belief, but a retreat into reassuring domestic ritual. And I suspect that's much greater for Jews than it is for Christians. I mean, there is a way in which one could say that belief is less important for Jews than observance.
I think that's very true. One could argue about the reasons for it, but I don't think Judaism is the only religion for which that's true. I think it's also true for Hinduism. I don't think the Hindus have ever looked very closely into what they all believe. They're allowed to believe in all sorts of things, but the important thing is, you know, the Brahmins are not supposed to cross the ocean, and you're not supposed to kill cows. That's what's important. What you really think about Brahma and Vishnu and Shiva, I don't think there was ever an inquisition in among the Hindus. On the other hand, then you have religions like Christianity, Islam, and I guess to some extent Buddhism. These are the religions that have missionaries that go out and try to convert other people. And it's in these religions that have universalist ambitions that theology becomes important. And it does become important. And in a way, I'm more attracted to that. Because as a scientist, I care about searching for truth and making a theory of the world. And Christianity, or Buddhism for that matter, provides an alternative theory of the world. And that's something I feel I have something to say about. I can interact with, I can respond to. On the other hand, if people just want to not eat pork or not kill cows or whatever it is, well, you know, more power to them. It has nothing to do with me, and there's no argument there.
So you feel a realistic and vigorous sense of opposition.
Yeah.
In that they are, that Christianity and Buddhism, in a rather different way, are in fact, as it were, more intellectually intelligible and complementary to a scientific worldview.
Yes, yes. They have a theory, and it's a theory that I don't agree with, but there is a theory there. And without a theory, what can I say? then it's not something that I can engage. I once wrote something rather disparaging about ultra-liberal Christianity, and that I found myself more, in some ways, more akin to a fundamentalist, because
at least they haven't forgotten what it is to believe something. And I got a copy of a fundamentalist newspaper from, I think, from New Mexico that praised me. Because what they really, I think what their real concern was not odd atheist physicists. That wasn't what they're worried about. What they're worried about are the liberal Christians.
Oh, I see. So that, in fact, that the fundamentalist Christians see you scientists as worthy opponents.
Well,
in the same way that you scientists or you physicists are seeing.
I wouldn't draw that implication. Mm. I think they just found a surprising ally in the battle that they really care about, their battle with the liberal wing of Christianity. But please don't let me give the wrong impression. I think enormous harm is done by religion, not just in the name of religion, but actually by religion. And
tell me the harm that is done by religion as opposed to the harm that's done in the name of it.
Well, I think people who crash airplanes into office buildings in order to destroy them must really believe in paradise, and that this is something that their God wants them to do, and that they'll be rewarded in paradise. And if they don't believe that, then it's a very foolish career move.
Yes.
The idea that God has, whether it's Allah or Jehovah or whatever, has dictated certain ways of behaving, certain ways of worshiping, and that it's incumbent on you to force others to behave that way and to worship in that way. God, think of all the harm that's been done throughout all the ages by people who believe that and believe it very sincerely. One could just go on and on and on about the number of very sincerely religious people who were led by their religion to do the most awful things.
But in fact, that was very much an aspect of before the diaspora.
Yes, and I do agree. But just coming back to what we were talking about before, it is the religions that have a theory of the world, it seems to me, at least in recent centuries, that do the harm. So the very sincere, true believers
are the ones you have to watch out for, even though they may have something more to show for themselves intellectually than the more liberal religious, but they're the dangerous ones.
Well, given the fact that the current president of the United States could be described as a sincere, true believer, I wanted to know whether Stephen himself was alarmed by the apparent growth of fundamentalist Christianity in his own country.
I don't see the United States in the grips of a really disturbing religious awakening. I think what's much more frightening in the world is Islam, where people, it seems to me, take their religion seriously to the point of madness. I think, you know, there have been times in the history of the world when Islam was a far more tolerant religion than Christianity, but that is not the case now.
In part three, Weinberg talks about Christianity and patriotism in America and how it compares with Christianity in Europe.
But there is undoubtedly, certainly for a European, the impression that there's a very strong association between Christianity and patriotism in the way that simply doesn't exist in Europe, certainly not in my own country, in the United Kingdom.
Yes, I know that that impression exists, and I think Americans think more highly of religion than Europeans do. I sometimes think that Americans believe in religion much more than Europeans do. They don't believe in God much more than Europeans do. But they believe that religion is good for you.
Oh, yes.
And without being particularly religious in any meaningful way. You know, I know many people who say they're religious and go to church every Sunday and belong to church organizations, and then when you
talk to them and you ask them, well, do you really, do you really think after death this is going to happen? They say, I have no idea. I don't know. It's all a mystery. But as I think it's good to be religious. This is the faith I grew up with. As a physicist, you have to decide what you think is true, and you get in the habit of that kind of intellectual activity. And because if you work on the wrong theory and it isn't true, you wasted your professional time, and you keep having to make judgments of truth or falsity, and so truth becomes very important to you. For most people, truth is not as important as good behavior or loyalty to your ethnic group or loyalty to your family traditions. And truth is something that you don't worry about very much.
Although, of course, that in the Middle Ages, and indeed when people were opposing atheism in the 17th century, it was insisted that the truthfulness of religion was what guaranteed good behavior.
Yes, and many people believe that. But an awful lot of people also believe it doesn't matter whether it's true, you have to be religious because that will guarantee good behavior. You know, the wonderful line of Gibbon's about the pagan religions, he said, in the multitude of gods, Gibbon said, the common people found them all equally true, and the philosophers found them all equally false, and the magistrates found them all equally useful. And I think many people in America and undoubtedly in Europe are in the position of the magistrates that Gibbon was talking about. They find them useful. Although I don't, I really don't think that, I don't see religion as actually inspiring moral behavior. In fact, you very often hear people say, well, these people who blow themselves up for some religious reason in the Middle East, or Hindu mobs who destroy a mosque, or Muslim mobs who kill Hindus, or that they're not really religious, that real religion doesn't involve that kind of behavior. I think what they're saying is that they have a moral sense which allows them to distinguish what is religious from what is not religious. I think, for example, George Bush said that these terrorists have hijacked a great religion. So, because their actions, their terrorist actions, don't fit his idea of religion. You see, what's really happening there is that instead of using religion to decide what is moral, they're using their moral sense, which fortunately is a perfectly good, reasonable, enlightened moral sense, to decide what is religious. And
if that's the case, then what's the point of the religion?
Finally, I wanted to know whether there were any particular reasons, apart from being constantly asked by people like myself, why Stephen felt it necessary to address himself to the topic of religion more than many of his colleagues did.
Oh, I try not to do it too much. You know, I don't want to become the village atheist, and I do get involved in a lot of other issues like missile defense and post-constructionism, neo-modernism. But I do spend probably a little bit more time than I should on religion, and I have a certain amount of hostility to it. I think the most rational reason for it is because of the harm that I see it does. We were talking about that earlier. Many people do simply awful things out of sincere religious belief, not using religion as a cover, the way Saddam Hussein may have done, but really because they believe that this is what God wants them to do. Going all the way back to Abraham being willing to sacrifice Isaac because God told him to do that. Putting God ahead of humanity is a terrible thing. Another reason is because I'm offended by the kind of smarmy religiosity that's all around us, perhaps more in America than in Europe. And not
really that harmful, because not really that intense or even that serious. But just, you know, after a while you get tired of hearing clergymen giving the invocation at various public celebrations, and you feel, haven't we outgrown all this? Do we have to listen to this? Yeah. But then, maybe at the very bottom of it, I really don't like God. You know, I mean, it's silly to say I don't like God because I don't believe in God, but in the same sense that I don't like Iago, or I don't like the Reverend Slope, or any of the other villains of literature, the God of traditional Judaism and Christianity and Islam seems to me a terrible character. He's a God who's obsessed with the degree to which people worship him and anxious to punish with the most awful torments those who don't worship him in the right way. Now, I realize that many people don't believe in that anymore, who call themselves Muslims or Jews or Christians, but that is the traditional God, and he's a terrible character. I don't like him. I have a friend, or had a friend, now dead, Abdus Salam, a very devout Muslim who was trying to bring science into the universities in the Gulf states. And he told me that he had a terrible time because although they were very receptive to technology, they felt that science would be a corrosive to religious belief, and they were worried about it. And damn it, I think they were right. It is corrosive of religious belief, and it's a good thing too.
That's terrific.
And that's the end of the Steven Weinberg interview. So this song is for you, Steven. Evolution Rocks by Overman with Aaron Kelly, Matthew Radowski, Russell Eggenberger, and Jason Burley.
Beautiful day in Chicago, and Overman is recording Evolution Rocks today at Uptown Studios.
Sometimes it's dangerous to think outside the box, to be different, to be unorthodox. It's just like Isaac Newton beneath an apple tree, and the theory of relativity. Charles Darwin was a naturalist, he had some funky ideas about how we exist, and he thought a lot about what makes living things the same. Selection, evolutionary change.
Now, pre-Darwinian science was influenced heavily by theology. It was believed that all organisms were created simultaneously by God, and all life forms were unchanging from the moment of their creation. Darwin thought, this can't be.
It was 1831 when the Beagle sailed the sea on a voyage that sowed the seeds for Darwin's place in history. They docked that tortoise island with some cactus by the shore, surrounded by Galapagos creatures they had never seen before. The finches' beaks weren't all the same, so Darwin gave the birds different names. Now back to England, good news for the king. The origin of species is a trace of fate.
And thus Darwinian science was developed. Evolution does occur. Evolutionary change is gradual and driven by natural selection. Every species alive today arose from a single original life form. Everything we have believed to this point is wrong.
On the origin of species, now Victorians be damned. Favorable adaptation of the livest to adapt. Competing for survival, heals offspring of the strong. The weak don't eat, I guess they don't belong. Evolution is natural, it's theorized, it's factual. Today, all the birds we see playing in the brush, once were feathered little dinosaurs, they've grown up so much.
Initially, there was much opposition to Darwin from religious thinkers and some scientists, but it was soon overcome. Evolution was accepted by the middle classes. The human race, the highest product of evolution, was now at the cutting edge of progress towards higher things.
So for 4 billion years now, the tree of life grows on. 99% of species have come and now they're gone. Assimilating the affinities are all made up of dust. It's okay to think this way, your God won't mind that much. Sometimes it's dangerous to stay inside the box. Keeping that in mind, I think evolution rocks. Keeping that in mind, I think evolution.
Animal Connection time, and I'm in the mood for some inspirational stories. So I'm going to read you some from my favorite organization, Best Friends Animal Sanctuary. And this is what I'd like to read from Wild Friends. They have a spot in their sanctuary called Wild Friends, and it's from Rescue to Release. With the white cliffs of the Grand Staircase, Escalante National Monument at her back, the red-tailed hawk hopped out of the carrier, finding herself in her own territory again after 6 months of rehabilitation at Wild Friends. She took a few moments to get her bearings and then took flight. There to witness the release of the hawk were the people who made her return possible. The Fielder family of Kanab, Utah. Thanks to them, the hawk was not left for dead along the side of a road where they found her injured, but was instead taken to Wild Friends. The next story I would like to read is a story about Schwartz and Darina. Who's the best helper for a special needs dog? Sometimes it's another special needs dog. And Darina has been saving the day for Best Friends dogs left and right. Darina is a beagle mix who was hit by a car. The driver didn't even stop. She lost one of her legs in the accident, and a second leg was permanently injured. So Darina will always walk differently. But far from letting this get her down, Darina has decided to be a special needs doggy hero at the sanctuary. It all started when she befriended Schwartz the Bulldog. At first, Schwartz couldn't find anyone to play with him at all. He came to Best Friends for special care because he was born with all sorts of abnormalities. Bred to have a face full of cute wrinkles, his were actually so deep that he needed antibiotics. And one of his legs had come out wrong, too. It was shorter than the others and twisted. But at Best Friends, there's no such thing as coming out wrong. The declaration of this peaceful place is that all animals are created equal. And Schwartz was welcomed with love, freedom, and top-notch medical care. The only problem? Some of the other dogs picked on him. The first roommate he tried was nasty to him. No matter how much he'd play, bow, and try to entice him to be friends. But Schwartz wanted company so badly. Enter Darina. She didn't care that Schwartz had a birth defect. Her attitude was, dogs who are different like us, we need to help each other. The next thing anyone knew, Schwartz was up and playing every day. Darina was always urging him to romp around with the others and put on a good game of chase. Suddenly, you'd never know he had special needs. Soon, Schwartz made it all the way through his recovery here at Best Friends and found a wonderful family. A couple in Southern California fell madly in love with him. They are bulldog experts and don't mind keeping up with his continuing special care. After a lifetime of discomfort, he's finally living with a family who say, We feel so honored to be allowed to adopt such a special boy and will strive to give Schwartz the life that every dog deserves. But what about Darina? While her work wasn't done yet, now there was a new dog who needed her help. Simba Sue suffers from crippling shyness. So what happened when she was moved into Darina's play area? Darina began coaxing her out of her shell, that's what. And it's working wonders. Darina has also been hanging around with Rhubarb, who has progressive neuropathy, and Chickle, who was being rejected by other dogs because he's too boisterous. Darina has become a hero to dogs who just don't feel like they fit in. And she will continue doing her work to help all these special animals. The next story I'd like to read is called Pigs in Tents. Cherry, she's a best friend's pig who arrived as a very shy homeless gal. But recently she snuggled up in a tent with a visitor. Lisa from Arizona and Carol from Pennsylvania were visiting best friends and had just decided to take one of the animals on a sleepover. Why not a pig? Next thing best friends knew, Lisa and Carol were presenting photographic evidence that Cherry the Bashful had not only been a fabulous guest at the slumber party, but she'd taken a nap alongside Lisa in a tent. This is one of the reasons I love Best Friends Animal Sanctuary. There are so many animals that people wouldn't adopt if it wasn't for Best Friends. And even if they don't get adopted, they live a most wonderful life at the sanctuary. It's one place that someday I would like to visit and just enjoy every one of these animals. There is something else I wanted to read. It's every year they have Strut Across America. They're having it this year in Los Angeles on September 24th, and they're also having it on September 25th at the Hudson River Parks Pier 84 in New York City. By going virtual September 18 to 25, Strut Your Mutt is expanding to all 50 states, allowing strutters to take part wherever they live, from Juneau, Alaska to Tallahassee, Florida, and everywhere in between. Greta Palmer, National Events Manager for Best Friends, explains, "It's a way for our No More Homeless Pets Network partners to fundraise using our Strut Your Mutt brand as their platform. They can use our existing resources, such as the Strut Your Mutt website and PR opportunities, as well as be part of a national collaborative initiative in which almost 100 rescue groups across the country are joining forces for the same cause, to raise money and awareness for homeless pets. And for our Best Friends members, it's a way to get involved in their communities to help support Best Friends. Registration for Strut Across America is absolutely free. You sign up as an individual walker, friends and family, or corporate dog pack to raise money for Best Friends, or as a No More Homeless Pets Network dog pack to raise money for that particular nonprofit. Walkers create a fundraising page on the Strut Your Mutt website, strutyourmutt.org, and then promote their participation by encouraging friends, family, and others to make a donation to the cause. If you live in Los Angeles or New York, where actual walks are taking place, Greta says, we would love for you to register for our anchor events in those cities. Best Friends supporters can join the Los Angeles Programs Dog Packs, led by Francis Batista, or the New York Programs Dog Packs, led by Gregory Castle. People can participate as a walker and attend the events, or join as a virtual participant and fundraise for those teams, says Greta. Virtual participants are still encouraged to take a special walk with their dogs during the week. So that's a wonderful way to make money for everyone who takes care of homeless animals. And that's it, folks. Good night.